then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 30th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Tell you what, let's let Gretchen kick it off this week.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing my second installment of Arthur Kemp's March of the Titans. Now, first of all, I'm going to talk about Spain and Portugal. Now, Spain and Portugal have very much a shared history. In ancient times, you had the Phoenicians, and then to a certain extent the Carthaginians. Then the Celts and the Greeks coming in to populate the area. And then for a very long time, for about 500 years, Spain and Portugal were part of the Roman Empire. Now, after Rome started breaking up and was really up for grabs, you had a lot of Gothic tribes coming in. And in fact, one of the first laws that you had in that area was that Goths could only marry another Goth. And in fact, the Spanish word for gentleman literally translates the son of a Goth. Now, eventually, this marriage law was watered down to be merely a religious law about Christians marrying Christians. Philip III actually expelled Christianized Moors who were mostly of mixed race. Over time, the Moors became more aggressive and they wanted to get into France. And that was how you have the situation with Charles Martel and the Seven-Day War and the very significant date of October 732 when the Moors were expelled after a battle that seemed really very hopeless and only turned around on the seventh day. However, even though the Moors were expelled from France, they were not expelled from Spain and Portugal until 1492. Now, at that time, not only the Moors were driven out from Spain and Portugal, but also the Jews. And the reason for this was because during the Battle of Toledo, there were a group of Jews that opened the city gates at a very critical juncture. And so they were expelled from Spain and Portugal, and a lot of the property was seized by the monarchy. After 1492, both Spain and Portugal did very well, and the Portuguese and the Spanish started to explore and colonize. However, in a certain sense, they were both the victim of their own success, because in the 1580s, both countries, but especially Portugal, started absorbing some of the Africans that had come from the colonies. In the year 1773, all the intermarriage laws were lifted, what little laws there were by that time. And in the 1960s, what ended up happening was a lot of the people from the colonies granted citizenship in Portugal, and so they started to pour in that way. The reason for all of these problems, one of the reasons anyway, was that Spain and Portugal always tended to pursue a form of colonization that I'll call single male colonization, where they really did not emphasize families. They emphasized males going out to colonize. And what happened, of course, was a lot of intermarriage. And so by the time these colonists were coming to Iberia, they had very little genetic connection with Southern Europe. Going back to the situation of France, the inspirational victory of Charles Martel really inspired the French. And in 768, Charlemagne wants to create a buffer state. He does, and I'm really going to have to skip over quite a bit here, but one problem that did come up that's rather interesting for those studying American history is when Charles II, who was one of the Habsburgs, willed his kingdom to France. And this started a dispute about secession and who would control territories. And that's what started the French and Indian Wars, if you've ever heard of those. And they ended in 1714 with the Peace of Utrecht. Now, fortunately, the French did not engage in the slave trade very much, at least, you know, in that time, they didn't absorb very many Negroes into France. They would, unfortunately, later on, but that would be much later. Eventually, what you came to in France and what triggered the French Revolution was Louis XIV, the Austro-Prussian War. By 1789, you started having various revolts, and in 1792, the French Revolution started to be in full swing, and you had the Reign of Terror. Now, one of the horrible things that happened with regard to the Reign of Terror in France was that the French started to see anyone who looked Northern European as potentially an aristocrat, and started to kill off these people that they thought were aristocrats. Now, to this day, what happened is it really killed off a lot of the Nordic genetic material in France, and today there's fewer Northern European genetic traits among the French. Now, one of the things that happened was that the people in those times soon realized that the Reign of Terror was real lawlessness. And that's what made the French really go for someone like Napoleon, who was really, would have been an Italian. He was really born of Genovese parents, but due to a technicality, he became French. The whole idea of the French Revolution and also Napoleon promoted arts and sciences and universal male suffrage and education. So there were some positive things that came out of it as far as social reform. The French during the late 1800s were very experimental, and in 1871, the capital was even held by a group of communists for a couple of months, so really the first communists. France did not start absorbing non-whites until you had the Algerian and French-speaking Africans coming in from French colonies. And that was in relatively modern times. That was after the First World War. You did have some black troops in the Ruhr Valley. This was one of the things that really rallied the Germans against the French. In World War II, France was occupied relatively quickly, and the Germans had a fairly light hand in France. And after the Second World War, Charles de Gaulle, who was really a moderate, made a rather long-winded and maybe somewhat apologetic statement about how he really could tolerate a few minorities in France, but did not want France to be overrun. Well, good luck with that, because the situation today is very different than I suppose what Charles de Gaulle could have imagined, although Adolf Hitler did imagine it if you read Mein Kampf, and he talks about a coming age of race chaos. Talking about England, it goes into all the various concerns with secession within England. It talks about all the Danish influence and Scandinavian influence that was in England during the medieval times, then the Normans coming in. Throughout, England really never had much of a race issue until relatively modern times. There were apparently some Moors in England that were expelled in 1601 by Elizabeth I. So that was one racial issue. And as we know, in the British Isles, a lot of issues between Protestants and Catholics, and also regarding the Scots and whether or not they could have independence. But the Scots also, and really to this day, and quite fortunately, remain very homogeneous and very white. They contributed a great deal to the British Isles. Also, he does talk about Scandinavia, and he talks about the Olaf dynasty and the issues there with Christianity and the fighting that came about with that. Of course, in that situation with Olaf, a lot of people died in that event under Olaf, and so that's something to look back and have some mourning about that. I'm trying to obviously cover a lot of ground here. This book has so much information. Of course, I can't cover everything, so I'm just trying to cover what various highlights I can find, and I'll be back next week talking about Wales and apparently, I'm sure, other subjects. I'll be excited to read more of this book, and especially to get into more modern times where really there start to be much more pressing issues. So I thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
I have no idea who this is.
We're ambitious.
We're funny.
We're shysty.
We play by our own rules.
And we can be very naughty.
But we're all chosen.
We're Jews. And for now, we're on top. We've had a great run, from politicians to media moguls.
Centuries of control.
But we know it won't last forever. So for these final years of Jewish dominance, we're going to soak it all in. I'm going to complain.
I'm going to fleece the goyim for trillions.
I'm going to promote lesbianism and hatred of white men.
I'm going to screw some shiks of whores.
I'll make more porn.
I'm going to suck as many baby dicks as I can.
Hey, let's make this a good trot around the bases.
Let's get at least one more Fed chairman, even if it has to be another Yenta.
Hey!
Let's never forget the things we have accomplished.
Because eventually we'll get kicked out, like hundreds of times before.
And then, it's all yours, Goyim!
Jews, still calling the shots till around 2018. 2020 tops.
Jews!
Right, as I've mentioned before on this show, I get all kinds of weird music submissions from all over the world, and this one is especially odd. For once, at least I know who did it. It's by a group called Redneck 28, and it's a country music, guitar picking, banjo plunking tribute to the sacrifice of millions of British soldiers during World War I. Don't ask me how this came about, but actually it's not a bad number. It's called Betrayed.
Upon the drum, they followed the piper, warrior. and the est.
Hate this place, this zoo, this prison, whatever you want to call it. I can't stand it any longer. And every time I do, I fear that I've somehow been infected by it. It's repulsive, isn't it?
Greetings from the Pacific Northwest. This is Stefan.
And Annie.
We are actually here in the Pacific Northwest.
Hey.
First time on a podcast.
Right, so it's been a while.
That's right. You know, it's been a while to set up all this stuff and that. We had it in storage and our recording gear and all that stuff. So.
Right.
Annie, why don't you tell folks about some of the difficulties we face with migration? Because I'm sure there's a lot of others wondering about that.
Okay. And for those of you listening, I have some moving tips on the forum, so you can go there for specific details, a lot of what I'll tell you on this podcast. One of the biggest challenges was when we arrived, we talked about saving and pick everything up and leave, and it was a little more difficult than what we planned for it to be, but it's very doable. However, we didn't think about a few things when we arrived.
That's right. We thought $8,000 was going to be plenty, and we thought we'd even have extra.
You know, right.
You know, to just blow on fun things on the way up here. But
we did have some fun, but we didn't go out of the budget at all, hardly.
Right. That is one issue that people, you probably need, what, $10,000?
Yeah, I think probably a couple of thousand more would have made it a little bit easier for us. A few of the things that we did, though, helped out coming up with what we packed. One of the things that we were most surprised and didn't think ahead about was having a place, you know, you think you've got all this money saved up, you've got really good resumes, you're going to get a job right away. But if you don't have a job, a lot of people do not want to rent to you, especially rental companies or whatever. So that was pretty surprising. It didn't occur to us that, or didn't occur to me, that you need to have a job before somebody will actually rent to you, even though you can prove you've got the money in the bank. You've got to have some kind of income coming in. There are some ways to get around that. So if you do make a plan and get up here, we can help you with that, with how we were able to get lucky enough to get into an apartment without being employed.
Right. So that's one thing to think about. I mean, if you got a fixed income or if you have like mega cash that you're bringing with you, that's different.
Yeah, but if you've got a retirement or you've got some kind of income coming in, it's probably going to be way easier than if you just sell your stuff and pack up and just arrive with a U-Haul truck.
Right. If you're the average younger white person, especially, or older, it doesn't matter. If you've just saved maybe a month or two's worth of paychecks, it's probably not enough. Now, you may be able to get by with less than that, less than $10,000, and maybe even half of that if you're willing to not bring very much with you. That way you won't spend as much on the moving truck and things like that, and you can get a smaller place, you know, and all those things are less money, of course.
Right. We sold most everything, but the things that we did keep that we had accumulated over the years, like dishes and things like that and linens, those are things that a lot of younger folks don't have. But it would be more expensive for us to purchase that at this point in life than to just get rid
right.
of it.
And it also is going to depend on how far you're traveling from. If you're traveling as far as we did, of course, the gas is astronomical if you're pulling vehicles with a truck and all that. So just things to think about.
Right. And several people have moved from 3,000 miles away or further. And it's interesting, when we arrived here, some of the comrades we talked to that have got just amazing stories, and you just go, wow. Coming with kids and dogs and
right.
loading up and kind of doing like we did. So it's pretty amazing. It was
Right. And real quickly, the folks up here were very gracious and welcomed us. And we had a nice little get together a couple of weeks after we got here. And
that was awesome. Yeah. Yeah. It was truly amazing how many folks we saw that are already in this community up here and how many ideas and suggestions and how much support, because
right.
Just the emotional support of saying, hey, how you doing? Or checking out.
Right. And we didn't utilize them as much as we could have probably. We like to do things ourselves, and probably a lot of others are like that too. We didn't want to have to ask people for things.
Right. But they offered even
right.
A lot of many, many times, a couple of several people, what do you need? What do you need help with? What do you have a question about? How can I help? And I think that is awesome. So we're here to do that for those of you that are on your way up too. One other thing that was hard for us is we both have really good skills, lots of experience, educated, and the job market is not as easy to get into as I thought it would be. So that was one thing that was surprising to us, is it just took a little bit longer. We are both employed now, but it took a little bit longer than what my expectation was, just because you don't have that same network of friends that you used to have.
Right. And that's going to depend on your field and all that stuff. I know what I wanted to do was a little bit different, and how do I say this without giving it away?
Well, you had to fall back on previous skills instead of the new direction we wanted to go.
Yeah, right. I did. Fortunately, I have a lot of different skills, and this is something to think about too. If one thing doesn't work out, you don't want to depend on one thing.
Right. And I've actually changed fields too, so it's all good.
Also, we should probably talk about some of the fear that people have.
Right. And we were talking about that. What do you expect when you come up here? We'd say, come up here and band together with us. Come up here and be a part of our group. What does that mean specifically? You know, are you going to come up here and all of us be yelling nigger, nigger, nigger and shoot the guns off? And, you know, we don't do that. It's a place to come where there are folks just like you that think the same way you do. You don't want your daughter dating a nigger boy, and you don't want your son coming home with a nigger girl. And the way you keep them from doing that, with all the brainwashing that's going on, is you put them in a community where they have enough white kids to play with and to see and to be around, to know that that is a normal thing to do, and that's your expectation. The other thing is, it's a place where we can get together, have a cookout, just chat. We don't sit around chatting about the niggers and what we're going to do. It's a normal picnic or cookout and chatting about work and school and kids and things like that. Now, other things come up as well, but it's not like we're sitting there planning and plotting. We say come band together. We're not going out into the streets and doing raids and stuff.
There's nothing nefarious about the Northwest Front. This is nothing illegal. This is simply folks. Now, there are a lot of different kinds of folks, just like there are in any large population.
Right, right. You know, you compare recipes, you talk about what's going on in the community, what's a good thing to do on the weekend. It's a place where if you say the word nigger, everybody doesn't gasp and call you out and make you leave. You know, you can be yourself, and just like you are at home.
And you can choose to be as involved as you want. You can just come here and keep to yourself and not even associate with the Northwest Front if you don't want to.
Right, right.
I think it's better if you do, because when things do start to go south, you're going to be able to have folks that really are prepared for that. And that's what this is about.
Right, preparing and having the food, because there's going to be a shortage when the EBT cards stop working. You know, I think that people think that's funny. I've said that to family members and they've thought that was funny as heck. Not that I'm worried about the food, but just that the food and water and being able to survive on your own and support each other and have a community. I guess think about the Amish. They're not going to have any problem. That's the kind of community you want to build. It's self-sufficient.
Right.
That you don't have a bunch of jigs in the middle of.
The more of us that have different kinds of skills and abilities and things like that, the better this community is going to be.
Right. We need a dentist. We need a vet. We need, you know, all these things to
right.
make our own little community.
It's going to be a target when it does break up. Let's say the United States does break up, which it eventually will. Maybe in our lifetime, maybe not. But when it does, what do you think is going to happen if this area has the stuff and the goodies and a decent place to live, whereas everything else, you know, the Southeast and in the Southwest is probably going to burn.
Exactly. We've already seen what happens down there. So you've got a lot of liberals in the Northwest, but you've got these smaller communities, and it's amazing how many of us there are, and we don't know everybody. But when we go someplace or go to a get together, it's a chance just to be yourself. And if you want to go out to dinner, you don't have to worry about if your work buddy's wife might be a nigger when they show up. That's you know, that's happened to me. And I was like, oh my gosh, had to leave. My friend got, she kind of got upset, but she understood. I just like didn't want to be there.
Oh yeah. That,
with this.
That time. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, that was.
All right. So what do you do when you come up here to the Northwest? What are we doing? We're just being ourselves, going about our daily lives and getting prepared for what's going to happen eventually in a very normal way. We're not some.
You still live your life like you would somewhere else. Most of the places, unless you're in a densely populated city, you're free of most of that trash.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We still have some dysfunctional whites, but that's anywhere in America.
Right. You have a big military bases up here, too. So you're going right. to see some of that interracial stuff. So it's
depending on where you are. Depending on where you are.
And roses and all that. But it's way better than where you are. I promise you.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time here. So I think we're going to wrap it right there. Any last word?
Nope. If you want to contact us directly, you can do that through the forum. You can send messages there, and you can also post on different things that we've got out there.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Okay, I want to add a few things to Stefan and Annie's migration commentary. Now, by the way, everybody up here has been extremely impressed with both of these comrades. They are exactly the type of people that we want to settle in the homeland in these early years. I also want to confirm, for those of you who are worried about whether or not you can get a job, that both of them are in fact employed now. It took about 3 weeks for both of them, I believe, and although neither of them is now doing exactly what they were doing back in the South, or exactly what they want to do, that will come in time. They've both got paychecks coming in, they're now on the ground floor of building their new lives here in the Northwest, and it took them about a month from the day they rolled into town. The economy up here in the urban areas of the Northwest is still good enough so you can do that. If you have any skills, work ethic, or work history at all, and you can get your ass out there and hustle when you arrive, you can get some kind of job in a few weeks. Yes, that's still possible here, unlike most places elsewhere in the United States. True, your first job in the homeland most likely won't be a lifetime career opportunity that will allow you to work for 32 years for the same company, build a house, and raise a family on one paycheck like my father did, but then nobody gets those jobs anymore anyway, anywhere in the country. Unless you're really connected with the Democrats and you go right on to the federal payroll out of college. But you will be able to make it once you get here. Now, Stefan and Annie made their migration the hard way, the whole nine yards. They followed my weekly exhortation on this podcast. They literally packed the moving van and came up here with no job and no place to live. They rolled into town up here in the Pugetopolis one bright summer evening in June with no place to go. Now, that can be a scary prospect. Hell, it's a scary thing to do. Believe me, I get that. I did it that way myself. Although in my case, there was no moving van. I had everything I owned packed into a 99 Corolla, and I had only about $2,000 in my kick. Of course, we knew they were coming, and we were here and available for any help we could give. The time will come, in that far-off distant day, when I can get you folks out there to take all this seriously, when the party will be able to do a lot more. When there will be a proper, professionalized Northwest agency to bring white people home, and when families of white migrants, who by then could probably be classed as refugees, will come into some Northwest town and they will have some kind of address to go where they can lay their heads for the night. I really am looking forward to when that day comes, but that's not my department, it's yours. Stefan and Annie are here now, and so are others. I will, in fact, be meeting our latest new arrivals here in the Pugetopolis this weekend. It's starting to happen, people. Okay, now, speaking of weird music that keeps coming in over the transom here, this is an artist from the United Kingdom who goes by the name of Ironwand. I have been assured by the person who sent me three of his songs that he's one of us, hence his inability to use his real name, which in the UK I get. But I played all three songs, and two of them don't seem to me to have any racial or political connotations at all. I mean, they're not bad, but they're not us. Certainly nothing that would get this guy busted under the Race Relations Act. This one is called War is Coming, and I suppose a certain us-ish interpretation could be put on it. I mean, the guy's not bad, but he's no Arlen Brand. ¶¶
always played it by the book. Always gave more than I took. Try to be fair, try to be good, and do the right thing if I could. But things have changed a lot around here, where there was laughter, now there's fear. They promised me some love hereafter, then just like that, they're shooting at you. Wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming soon. I'm a bad man if I durst put my kith and kinfolk first. Well, I'm sick and tired of being pleased, of my whole world being thought policed. Wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming. I was born to sympathize, never been a bad man in disguise, but now I'm forced to celebrate every last thing that I hate. Wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming. That I maintain, call me names if I complain. I gave it all, they give me nothing, so what do I care if they think I'm bluffing? Wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming. Better get yourself prepared, you don't want to hang with the rest of the herd. Sheep, lemming, cattle, mouse, they're on their way to the slaughterhouse. Wars are coming, wars are coming. Look at the chemtrail in the sky, isn't it time to wonder why? Love a mother, hero, dreamer, light them all up for the next Fukushima. Wars are coming, wars are coming. How come that your new world order left my whole world without border? You gave away my wonderland to the alien hogs of the hip and ham.
Wars are coming, wars are coming.
You must have seen the writing on the wall. Haven't you read the 17th protocol? You just gotta wake up to the master plan when they're doing away with Superman.
Wars are coming, wars are coming.
All the false flags they create to subjugate the nation state. How many more will the company kill for the Wall Street wolf and the dollar bill?
Wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming, wars are coming.
Okay, rather than have this podcast turn into one long whine about my lost novels, for which there will be plenty of time in the future, and in view of the fact that you guys just heard over an hour of my contemporaneous ranting and raving, I've decided to break the pace here a bit and do something that I normally don't do, which is to read one of my own articles. Now, this is one of my more famous pieces, dated April the 20th, 1999. Written when I was living in a crack house in Texarkana, Texas. One of the first things I ever wrote on my old computer that just died recently. Now bear in mind, this is from my pre-Northwest and openly national socialist period, which will account for some of the dated material and terminology. It's called Dreaming the Iron Dream. comrades and brothers. As the last summer of this most terrible of centuries begins, I find myself thinking of a day in early summer 28 years ago. On that day, having completed my last final exam and thus my last day at Chapel Hill High School, I walked up to my car in the parking lot on a hill beside the school. I stopped at the summit of that hill and turned, looking back at the buildings, remembering all that had occurred there over the past 3 years. In that moment, I made a silent vow to myself that I would devote my life to ensuring that someday no white boy or girl would ever again have to go through what I had to go through in that place. To my frequent amazement, this vow of mine I have kept through almost 3 decades of chaos and madness. The century draws to a close, and it is not inappropriate, I think, for us as a group to pause for the few remaining months of it and assess where we have all been and what we've done. Many years ago, an author named Norman Spinrad wrote a book called The Iron Dream. The book was not a very memorable one, a kind of literary joke purporting to be what Adolf Hitler would have written had he emigrated to the United States after the Beer Hall Putsch and become a science fiction writer in New York. Yet the phrase has stuck in my mind. I think it is a very good one, very descriptive of the kind of vision that National Socialism has for Aryan mankind. National Socialism itself might be said to be an iron dream, a vision of a world and a human identity that endures like the hard metal instead of decaying like mere flabby flesh, and where the soul of man is hard and strong instead of weak and vacillating. The Iron Dream is the hidden instinctive soul of our mighty race. It lurks beneath the surface of the mind and the desire of every white man and woman ever born, for it is the gift of the god or gods who forged our people from the ice and snow and granite of the vast forested expanse of our ancient homeland. All my life I have dreamed the Iron Dream. I don't know why. Some are simply born out of step with their time, I suppose. Even as a child, I understood that things around me weren't right somehow, that this was not the way life was supposed to be. Always, I've been haunted, obsessed by a vision of a world very different from the one in which I grew up, an all-white world with very different standards and priorities, a world of strength and valor and glory, full of the qualities and virtues and experiences which have been so deliberately bred out of us by Judaic materialism. When I was young, I had an idealized view of the past, all white faces, of course, but I had no idea of what this brave new world should be like in the future, until I discovered and understood the true meaning of Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich, and National Socialism. I have served the Iron Dream since that time, because for me, there was no other conceivable path. Every opportunity which presented itself for me to conform, and there were many, I rejected out of hand. It would not have been hard. Like the ancient Roman Emperor Domitian, all the power structure asked was that occasionally I burn a small pinch of incense on the altars of the false gods of Judaism and materialism. But not once in my life have I ever burned that small pinch of incense which would have been my ticket into the wonderful world of money and consumer goods. That symbolic gesture of submission which would have meant, among other things, that I would have a medical insurance policy when I reached middle age. At age 17, I recognized a racial, moral imperative which demanded my full attention and dedication, and I have submitted to it without question ever since. Not the usual 20th century life story, to be sure, or at least not very common since 1945. Making my peace with the system, a phrase I have actually heard used in the past few years by some people who were once active in the resistance, is something which simply never occurred to me. If I had it all to do over again, I'd change some things, sure, but I would take essentially the same path I've taken. I've never looked back. I've spent a large portion of my life making demands on you people, collective generic you, those of us who are racially conscious and who know the truth. I'm forever asking you to do things that you do not wish to do. In essence, I have demanded and continue to demand that you come up to my standards. I've done so not in my name, but in the name of the Führer Adolf Hitler, and in the name of generations of white children yet unborn, both of whom have the right to demand that sacrifice and that action from you. I have done and said things that have made you feel extremely uncomfortable. I've spoken aloud of things you feel are better left discreetly unspoken. I've pointed the finger and named names, saying, "Thou art the man." I will continue to do and say these things because it is my duty to do so, because these things must be done and said, and no one else will. Fraud is the curse of our movement, more than anything else the cause of 50 years of failure. Let me tell you how to spot a movement fraud in one easy lesson. A movement fraud demands only 2 things of you, your money and your applause. He never asks you to take any risk. Indeed, he would prefer that you did not, because if you lose your job, you can't contribute money to him, now can you? He never asks you to undertake any inconvenience. He never asks you to sacrifice or to endure persecution and pressure and loss and danger for the Aryan race. He convinces you that he will do all these things for you, that the great result can be achieved without you yourself assuming any part of the burden which history has placed on our generations of Aryan men and women. In this, the movement snake oil salesman lies. Nothing worth having is ever obtained without a struggle and without cost, and everything worth having is always the result of duty accepted and fulfilled. The Iron Dream can be made reality. Indeed, time and again, down through the centuries, our people have made it a reality, but it requires blood and sweat and gold and tears, prison and death and long years of toil and grinding poverty. Anyone who does not tell you this is lying. Above all things, National Socialism means duty. Duty to oneself, to be true to one's racial destiny. In this soft and supine era, most white men run away from duty, will do anything to avoid it, for it is difficult and demanding and interferes with their television. Yet throughout past ages, real men have always embraced duty, sought it out, made it the touchstone of their lives. Man without duty is simply a pig wallowing in the trough, another form of animal life. Man without a higher duty to spiritual principle is a Jew. To be a National Socialist, to dream the Iron Dream, is to become a servant of history, to take upon oneself the burden of deciding in what form human destiny will be shaped. To be a National Socialist means taking on not only responsibility but moral authority, the right to determine the fate of others, and that is a terrible duty to assume, one which frightens and horrifies most modern men. To be a National Socialist entails the courage to determine that this society is sick beyond saving, and that mercy itself requires its swift extinction. To be a National Socialist requires cultivating the character, the intelligence, and the moral strength to recognize the true issues at stake for our race and our civilization in the face of overwhelming public distortion and pressure to conform, and to accept the persecution and the hatred that comes with nonconformity. One of the first things that struck me at Chapel Hill High when I began to observe racial reality at first hand was how afraid the white students and teachers were of everything. They were afraid of the niggers physically, but more than that, they were afraid of becoming involved, of making moral decisions based on what was right as opposed to what was expedient. Afraid of taking a stand in the face of the liberal power structure against the blacks' violence and drugs and their destruction of the learning environment. For the first time, I ran into a phenomenon I was to encounter again and again in my adult life. Everyone around me knew perfectly well that I was right about the blacks, but no one dared to stand at my side and battle with me against institutional wrongdoing. White fear has always filled me with shame, for more than anything else, cowardice disgraces our heritage and degrades our folk. I've striven to show other white people, by the example of my own life, that they can rise above it. I've often thought that one reason I have been unable to get any help is not because no one understands what's required, but because most people do, in fact, understand these things, and aside from all other considerations, they're terrified by the responsibility of taking upon themselves the burden of history.
Thank you.
The human reality is that most people simply do not have what it takes to be a revolutionary, and that is true in every era. But the fact that most people aren't up to the task doesn't mean that the task need not be done. Racial survival is something that we cannot take a pass on. The racial extinction of the white man is not an option. Someone has to step forward, and I have always accepted the fact that for whatever strange karmic reason, I have drawn that short straw in this life. Sometimes I've wished it wasn't so, but my duty station is assigned, and I remain at my post. The Western world has reached a turning point by the steep stages of a crisis mounting for generations, a crisis brought on us through our own weakness and cowardice and sloth. Several times throughout this terrible century, in Rhodesia, in South Africa, in the American South, twice in Germany, Aryan man has attempted without success to resist the onslaught of the crawling chaos which is known under so many names. Liberalism, socialism, diversity, political correctness, multiculturalism, humanism, all the various nicknames under which Judaic Marxism and its twin brother Judaic capitalism disguise themselves. And believe me, Marxism is alive and well in the world today. We have resisted thus far without success, but that does not mean that we must cease to resist or that those of us who know the truth can ever resign from the struggle. I say to you again, the racial extinction of the white man is not an option, and anyone who accepts it as such in order to avoid the effort and danger of racial duty damns his immortal soul to hell. We as a people must acquire the will to survive the crisis of civilization where that will is elsewhere divided, wavering, or absent. At issue is whether our sick and weakened society, which we call Western civilization, and which is the sole product of the Aryan race, can in its extremity still call up men and women whose faith in it is so great that they will voluntarily abandon those things which men hold good, including life, in order to defend it. To be a part of this process, to be a soldier in this world-shaking conflict, is not a negative thing to be avoided, but an honor, the greatest privilege which can be granted to any man or woman, and it is a destiny which I would not have missed for the world. The pain that these past 28 years have inflicted upon me is something that I cannot even begin to describe to you, but I understood from the very beginning that such pain would be part of the price tag attached to doing my duty, and I accept it without cavil. Someday you will accept it too, for despite my periodic dressings down, I know full well that you are not bad people and that you perceive in your hearts that you as well have a share in this destiny. However much they may deny it, there persists in every white man and woman a scrap of soul, some faint remnant of conscience. Few white men, no matter how sunk in the fleshpots of Jewish materialism, are so dull as not to understand, in at least some part of their consciousness, that the crisis exists. It is, in fact, a total crisis, political, moral, intellectual, religious, social, and economic. Nothing more or less is at stake than the continued existence on this earth of people with white skins. You know this, and someday you will join me. This is inevitable, although I make no secret of my hope that it will be sooner rather than later. National Socialists are bound together not only by a common devotion to our immortal leader and his ideals, but by a bond of blood which reaches across the barrier of nations, differences of class and education, in defiance of every Jewish rule and tenet. Our race is our nation. This mighty faith in our own heritage and destiny will someday give us the power to move mountains, and the time will come when at long last we will move men as well. National Socialists are that fragment of Aryan mankind who have recovered our people's long-lost ability to hold convictions and to act upon them, to live and to die for our faith. There is no greater human calling than to sacrifice one's life, either in death or in selfless lifelong devotion, poverty, and obloquy, to an ideal greater than the self. Now, this is what National Socialism calls upon Aryan men and women to do. In these times of timidity, prosperity, and inertia, it is not a popular message, but a few in every generation respond to it. For idealism is in our very genetic makeup, and however deeply we smother it in the material wealth and indifference of the Judaic world in which we rot, it will always shine through. The spark of this divine essence within our Aryan souls is still there. You feel it yourself, or you wouldn't be reading these lines now. I know full well that this summer, as occurred to me on that summer day 28 years ago, all across this land there are a small number of young men and women who are looking back at the place where they have just spent some wretchedly miserable years, and they are dedicating their lives to a future where it won't happen again. I've already met some of this new generation, and I hope to meet more of them someday, to give them the benefit of my experience and to let them know that they are heirs to the glorious legacy of Hitler and Rockwell. That legacy will come to fruition in the 21st century, and this will happen because a small band of us willingly gave up our places at the great consumer trough, our chances for what politically correct society calls happiness, in order to answer the call of our racial duty. It is we who will vindicate our people before the bar of history, we small band of brothers and sisters, who gave it all up to do what was right instead of what was convenient or what was socially acceptable. I would not resign my membership in this tiny elite for any price. It's hell out here, people. It's dirty, it's shabby, it's dangerous, it's depressing, it's hard and brutal. And it is unspeakably glorious. Join me. Join me. Let us dream the iron dream together that someday the world may awake to that day of blood and fire and renewal which will usher in the greatest imperium of mankind. Well, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.